this evening. So this is the first colloquy series that we're inaugurating at CERL, and we're delighted to welcome Ian Warwick as our first speaker this year. It's running a collaboration with Education Society, and we're going to be putting on a series of talks once every half term by leading experts in education and important themes in teaching and learning. We record these for a podcast we're launching later this year, and we're also interviewing our speakers. So Ian and I had a very fun interview about an hour ago where we talked about many things, including the topic of the scene, and that will be part of the podcast as well. So Ian is founder and CEO of London Gifted and Talented. He founded this as part of the groundbreaking London Challenge, which has transformed education across London since 2003. That organisation has directly worked with over 4,000 schools, 11,000 teachers internationally, and more than 150,000 educators worldwide have used London Gifted and Talented's award-winning Harvey Challenge e-learning materials. Ian has published many books, and I understand he's currently working on three more. Amongst his books are Educating a More Able Student and World Class, both of which were published in 2016. And he co-authored two books for Routledge last year, Redefining More Able Education and Redefining English for the More Able. His most recent book, Learning with Leonardo, Unfinished Perfection, focuses on Leonardo da Vinci and explores strategies for improving creativity and innovation. And that book is the topic of this evening's talk, Learning with Leonardo, Invention, Thinking Aside, and Adjacent Possibilities. If any of you would like a copy of that book, please let us know. Please give a warm welcome for Ian Warwick.
Okay, what I want to kind of go through, looking at some of Leonardo's works, looking at some of the kind of philosophy that sits behind what he did, how he did it, and then looking at what each of those things may actually have an implication in terms of how we learn, but more importantly, what we need to do as teachers and as students and as learners to develop ourselves. These ideas around invention, thinking aside, adjacent possibilities will be just three of the sections of the book. Essentially, the book is divided into seven key sections, seven key ideas, which I will go through with you. And then we're going to hone in on maybe these three, just to have a look and see the implications, what that might look like. One of the things that have been a huge blessing is that there are about 7,000 pages of notebooks that we still have access to. So there's an awful lot of information still about him. And one of the things that attracted me originally to it is that he was not so kind of divine lightning genius. He was absolutely someone for whom a lot of these things came very difficult. And he got a lot of his maths wrong. When he kind of threw himself into a whole load of different studies, whether he finished them or not seemed to be almost a matter of irrelevance to him. He was far more focused on becoming Leonardo than he was in terms of becoming a teacher or passing on any of this information, these ideas, his key thinking. Many of the notebooks were lost for centuries. So one of the issues that we have is that he died 500 years ago. A lot of the work that he'd been doing has now been looked at by anatomists who are seeing how far in advance, many, many centuries in advance of his time, that he was actually working. But it wasn't shared. And that's not his fault. Essentially, it's an issue that's happened. There's nothing much we can do about it, but it seems to be an enormous waste of a man who kind of forked lightning across his time and then was seemingly lost. You probably know that he was illegitimate. He was very poorly educated. He was gay. There were a lot of kind of disadvantages that at the time he had to wrestle with. He was a complete agnostic, so at a time when people were killed for expressing ideas, many of his ideas, he just one note in his notebook, the sun does not move. essentially an observation that he'd made, that perhaps all of the teachings of the Bible, all of the teachings that he had learned about the Earth being the centre of the universe, probably was not true. And those kind of observations that he made would have had him killed. So he had to be quite cautious with these notebooks. There's a lot of evidence to suggest he wrote everything backwards in the notebooks. He had a kind of coding system that he hid an awful lot of his real understanding about what was going on. But he was light years ahead of the intellectual underpinnings of his time. So the kind of key element I would say here is this is a man who earned his genius. About 500 drawings in the work, 35,000 words, scattered over a dozen notebooks, pretty much on every topic that caught his imagination. But as I said, he had a kind of very free-range mind. He was interested in astronomy, he was interested in fossils, he was interested in anatomy, and in mechanics, and in motion, and in light. So he had no idea that these were kind of separate disciplines. As far as he was concerned, they were simply the idea of bringing him personal satisfaction, personal joy in what he learned and how he learned it. He was certainly never interested in consensus. He was always foraging for knowledge and trying to understand the odd, the peculiar, the thing that didn't seem quite right. I chose this picture very particularly because it's that kind of old man with a 500-year-old gaze looking at us. But one of the things I would say about him was that he had a beginner's mind. And he relished that. He relished the fact that even though he had become an expert in many of these areas, he never saw himself as having frozen his thinking as an expert. He was far more interested in looking at everything anew, as if it was the first time he had seen something. And I think that's something that perhaps we've lost in kind of modern education. He searched for what I call in the book adjacent possibilities. So these disciplines that he ranged across, he was very happy to kind of look at each one through the lens of another one. We've become very specialist in our education now, and it seemed to be a good thing that we specialise in one particular area. And what I find interesting is that many of the great scientific discoveries that moved the kind of paradigm shifts that have occurred recently have been when mathematicians, for example, change field and they go to physics, or a physician changes field and goes into maths. And they suddenly see things, they have their expertise, but they see things in a different light. They see things in a slightly different way. And that's what I mean, and I think what he did, in terms of adjacent possibility. There were loads of things there that he could kind of shine a light onto. He also learned very scatteringly. And what I mean by that was, he kind of went after all of these different fields of work, often all at the same time. He was kind of like an explosive firework. And what I find fascinating about him was that there seemed to be nothing that he wasn't interested in. There's quite a famous example of him going around the caves, in the hills, and he's trapped outside this cave, and he's terrified of going in. It's a huge cavern. He's never seen it before. And he's terrified of going in, and he talks about this kind of time of desire and fear. You know, the desire to go in and find out what he could, but the utter fear of what may be in there. And I think one of the issues that we have in our own lives is that perhaps fear wins a lot of that time. He went into the cave. In that cave, he happened to discover the fossil of a whale in the hills around Tuscany. And it made him immediately question some of the things he'd been told about evolution. Well, the kind of the way of the world. There was no such thing as evolution in his time. He hints at evolution a great deal, in fact. But he's 200 or 300 years ahead of Darwin in this. But the idea that perhaps these fossils indicate something about the way the Earth evolved. And that he found fascinating. And with all of this, the artwork manages to kind of straddle these contradictions. He pulls all these ideas together, but he's quite happy not having to reach for an answer, reach for a conclusion. He's quite happy being in the position of understanding contradiction and sitting with it and allowing himself to feel the ambiguity and not to kind of reach out for something, you know, that he kind of essentially needed and an answer for it. So we're looking at the seven key concepts that drove his thinking. These are ideas that they're not his. Having done probably about 6 or 7 years research now on him, these are the kind of concepts that I've put together, which I believe are valid in terms of his thinking. And then looking at how we now can use them to improve our own creativity. And what that kind of genuine universal mind might look like. What are the kind of components of creativity? And what are the approaches we need to take that will make our own learning a little more original, a little kind of more interesting and thoughtful? So these are the seven. And I'll go into each one of these with a single slide afterwards to kind of give you an indication of what I think the key elements of each of these would be. So the first one I've called conscious ignorance. And it's the idea that when you enter into a field, you enter it into it with eyes wide open and are open to the kind of possibilities. You are curious, you are full of wonder. But once you become more expert, the danger is that you get this kind of almost like kind of cognitive block. You've become an expert, and therefore you view your opinions as the opinions, the significant opinions, the expert opinions. And you don't move beyond that. And one of the things that fascinated me with him was that he was very happily walking into new situations as if it was the first time he had seen something. The second one is a round thing I call regaining wonder, which is this idea of the fuel of enthusiasm. Why do we learn? What's in it for us? What are we learning in this kind of process? And I go into a bit more detail about what those kind of things may look like, because those two go quite nicely together. The third one is around perfecting attention. And for him, that was about the kind of sensory approach to life. He believed that his own personal experiences were hugely significant. And he tested everything, he interrogated everything on the grounds of the kind of five senses that he had open to him. And the way he goes about it and what that means, I think, is also highly significant. And I think we've lost a great deal in terms of that. And this idea of perfecting attention, the formation of attention is one of the single most important things that we have as a learner. And as a learner, if you can attend to what is going on around you, if you can attend to what you need to focus in on, that I think is hugely significant. Fourth one is around a thing called unnecessary beauty. So this is about dialogues across disciplines. He regarded art and science as pretty much the same thing. There was no kind of major distinction as far as he was concerned. One was a story, a narrative that occurred like this, and another was a story, a narrative that occurred like that. So when you look at his notebooks, a lot of the work that you see in the notebooks, staggeringly beautiful, but for no audience whatsoever, other than himself. And I'm kind of curious about that. I'm kind of really interested about what that might look like. Thinking aside, this approach is around metaphor. It's around looking at how we pull together unconnected ideas. And Leonardo definitely believed that he called it the law of continuity. If you pull opposing ideas together and allow your mind to wander on those two ideas, they will form connections, they will form patterns, and those patterns will move you into the next phase of your thinking through metaphor, through analogy. And It's a very important idea. And again, I suspect we're losing out with some of this at the moment. Negative capability is a nicked idea. Anyone who's doing English will recognize that phrase. It's a phrase by John Keats in a letter he used to his brother. And Keats meant it in terms of the ability to hold utterly contradictory ideas and not reach after fact. And he saw that as almost the basis of intelligence. Developing productive frustration. That sounds like a kind of weird combination, productive frustration. My concern, my worry is that in the age of Google, students don't have the opportunity to be frustrated, bless you, to be frustrated. They put in a question, an answer comes back within 0.0001 seconds, and they mistake that for the truth. They mistake that for actually what they need to be thinking about. And actually, one of the great things before Google was this idea that you really had to work at your passion. You had to work at your thinking. And this kind of productive frustration was that you had to pursue it, you chased it, you followed it down the line, you went down kind of weird pathways, eventually you got to what you were asking or finding out about. And you remember it, you remember the journey. Whereas there's very little memorable about what you do with Google. And it's not saying that Google in itself is a bad thing, but it's suggesting this idea that an instant answer is very dangerous. And the way we use instant answers is also quite dangerous. And the final concept is what I call unfinished perfection. Given the fact that he lived to quite an old age, given the fact that he immersed himself in all these different fields, given the fact that he seems not to have spent a single hour of his life not thinking about things, we have very little to show for his productive capacity. There's maybe 15 major artworks. They happen to be the most well-known artworks on the planet, but, you know, the diagram of Vitruvian Man, the diagram of the fetus, the picture of the Mona Lisa, these are kind of huge works of art, but there are very few of them. And even the ones that he produced, he was still working on his deathbed. So it's this kind of idea of not letting go of something until you believe that it's as good as it could possibly be. You're not abandoning the chance of perfection, but you are abandoning this idea that you're going to reach it. So he's developing what I refer to as sustained irresolution. He's moving forward, bit by bit. This is the first one, conscious ignorance. This is one of his to-do lists. This is a kind of an illustration. I don't know if you can read some of this, but he's talking about getting masters of arithmetic to show him how to do squaring of a triangle. Stuff around medicine and law and proportion. He's looking at bombardiers, meaning by which the towns are walled without loophole. As one of his additionals, draw Milan. It's a kind of idea of you get a kind of sense of the man in that to-do list. There's almost nothing that he didn't think he could do. And I'm astonished by this. I find this kind of thing quite beautiful as well. But this is the kind of thing that he wanted to think about. Say,
try to get
Vitolan, Medieval Author of Texts of Optics, which is in the Library of Pavia, which deals with the mathematics. So he was really interested, inevitably, around how we saw things and laws of perspective and optics. And as soon as he found out that someone knew something about it, he was immediately there to try and find out as much as he could about it. Now, these are the kind of skills that you kind of indicate what he's doing here. So that mentioned, that phrase I used before, foraging for knowledge, anything that he could find. The phrase cultivating a wise unknowingness, that's another ripped off phrase that Johnny will recognize, but wise unknowingness, and wise passivity, were Wordsworth's ideas of how you receive new information. Breaking up our familiarity, key for him. If you become too familiar with something, you go through life on autopilot. And that was the one thing he sought to change, that he wanted to experience things new. Proust talks about the real voyage of discovery consisting not in seeking new landscape, but in having new eyes. The lens by which you look through something is significant. And the phrase here about the anesthetic of familiarity. When we become used to something, we become anesthetized to other things that are around us that may not fit in with the way we see the world. So this is the first phase, conscious ignorance. Second one is around regaining wonder and enthusiasm. He went about looking at the world and piecing it together bit by bit. And there's this kind of idea of scattering understanding that he's pulling together. He understood that we don't know knowledge. We have to debate it. It's always on the cusp of our understanding, but the debating is key. And it's how we engage with our work and our lives. Quote here again, it's an English quote, feed ourselves with questioning. Okay, the idea of really looking at how questioning whatever is around us can move us forward to the next idea. And that we are fed, we get sustenance from our questioning. And allowing the unknown to illuminate the known. He was a very strong believer that the unconscious was a fantastic way of pulling contradictory ideas together. And discoveries are often made through the unconscious kicking in a thought pattern. Something that a number of scientists have talked about themselves as well. So that they may be trying to find the structure of benzene. And they have a dream about the structure of benzene, in that case, of a snake eating its own tail. And that certainly gives them an idea of what that structure may look like. So it's understanding that we have a way of looking at the world and understanding that we need to allow the unknown to illuminate the known. So here, quite a famous picture of his, where actually we're in the cave, but somehow the light is coming in from the known world and illuminating what is inside, illuminating what is unknown. And that kind of idea of wonder is key. Wonder is the kind of, I believe strongly that wonder is the kind of foundation of all philosophy. Third phase is around this idea of perfecting attention, a sensory approach to life. Obsessive noticing. Now, he, for example, gave himself tasks of trying to understand how dragonflies' wings worked. And he knew there were four wings, what are each wing doing at each point in the kind of flight? And he followed that through, he understood it, he got it. He gave himself a whole series of other tasks, finding out the tongues of woodpeckers. Again, why? What's going on here? But something intrigued him enough to want to know about it. And the idea that he could describe how a dragonfly flew centuries before cameras, centuries before, let alone slow motion cameras, is quite astonishing. He gave himself the task and he insisted that that's what he could do. Sense of shaping of the invisible, how we pull our experiences together, how we refine our responses to things. And all of this is about interrogating reality. He was not keen on this idea that we understood through things we read. He was far more, what can I do to discriminate? What can I do that I kind of look at something and I use that experience of that thing. That's where my understanding comes from, not from other people's viewpoints and other people's perspectives. And that simple idea of paying attention to our attention. He believes strongly that all knowledge had its origins in perception. And I think for the time, that's a significant belief. The next one, unnecessary beauty. This is around developing a dialogue across disciplines. The idea of studying the science of art and the art of science. What are these kind of mental cross-fertilizations between different disciplines? This is a map he drew of a town called Imola. How he drew that map, no one kind of knows. It's quite astonishing. It's also one of the first times anyone had ever done anything like this in terms of the... it was highly useful for anyone who wanted to invade the town of Imola. But these are the kind of things that he put together. He was also a kind of cartographer. And you look at it and just think to yourself, what's going on in terms of what sparked the inquiry that sits behind this? Well, wanting to know how things work. Surrendering our preconceptions, surrendering what we think we already know about something, and looking at it in a new way. And those different lenses that spark inquiry. I think, I'll move on to the fifth one. This is around this metaphoric perspective that I mentioned earlier. How we develop the unconscious as a matchmaker between these disciplines. How we understand connections and patterns between things. He was utterly obsessed with water throughout his life. Lobbing stones into a pond. There's a quite a famous story where he's watching the ripples on the pond and he's listening to bells ringing behind him. And immediate connection being made between the ripples on the pond and the sound waves. And he starts to think of sound as a wave. Again, centuries before that was a thing. He played around with water, he played around with gaps in the water and holes and moving things around. His last works were all around the deluge and the kind of flooding. It was something that utterly fascinated him. And it kind of works quite well for this idea of using the unconscious, the kind of fluidity of the unconscious as something to move your life forward. And this adjacent possibilities, he called all of this, he talks about the law of continuity. And what he meant by that was that all things, apparently dissimilar ideas, will always have a connection. And if you allow your mind, a quote for him, by thinking about something that is not related, different unusual patterns are activated. Simply pulling these things together, pulling these ideas together, and the mind will have to find a connection to it. And that is an interesting idea in itself. And so in that way, kind of making strange the unknown. How we interpret and how we exchange meaning was what he was all about. Negative capability. There's a really interesting quote, I think it's Feinstein, a physics professor. What is not surrounded by uncertainty cannot be truth. What is not surrounded by uncertainty cannot be truth. What he's looking at in some of these kind of fantastic, this is the first helicopter drawing. What is difficult? What is desirable? Why do those two things go together well? And normally we view difficulty somehow as anti-cognitive. Why would you put yourself into difficulty? But he believes that kind of cognitive conflict was the significant part of moving our thinking forward, and how old problems can be seen from new angles. The way we accept. His fear was that we accepted consensual ideas because it was convenient to do so. It served our interest to do so. But he believed in that acceptance of the uncertainty and putting ourselves and keeping ourselves in a position where we don't quite know what we're doing. Research now in education talks about liminal learning. And the idea of liminal learning very much is this idea that you try and keep students right at the very edge of what they know, what they understand. And it's an uncomfortable space to be in, but actually it's the only space that makes any sense for us as teachers. If we can maintain students in this kind of zone, any advice we give is genuine advice that will move them forward. And that liminality is key. If students are doing second best work, essentially, they could change the work for themselves. They don't need us in that kind of process. So it's only when they don't know how to do something, it's right on the very cusp of what they can understand, that is the point where our intervention and our feedback makes sense in the kind of working world. And critically here, just understanding the importance of doubt, why doubt itself matters. He talked about confused things kindling the mind to great invention. Beautiful phrase, beautiful idea. And again, it's something that's not kind of immediately, we look at confusion as if it's a bad thing. But for him, it was the thing of infinite possibility. And that state of confusion means that we have to fight our way around and get an understanding of where we are and what we're doing and how we get out of this situation. For him, that mattered. And as I said, a lot of his ideas came from this idea of straddling these kind of contradictions. And he saw the production of any painting as a process of searching. So you discover the image in the course of doing it. You discover the image itself in the course of actually making that image, rather than having an idea of what you want to do beforehand. And one of the things about innovation, I think, invention, is that it requires almost a reality distortion field. We almost have to kind of think about innovation as the breaking of the kind of real world as we understand it. Can't see this picture too well, but this is unfinished perfection, sustained irresolution. You can see perhaps here, there are no kind of fixed images, there are no fixed edges in any of this. It's all around shadow. And for him, the shadow was the significant part of it. A great deal of this is left completely unfinished. This hand, for example, is kind of almost like a cartoon drawing of a hand. He managed to do what he wanted to do here. That was the key thing for him. Once he nailed that, almost anything else that was going in this picture became semi-relevant to him. He got the bits that he needed. But also there's this kind of sense, the technique that he uses here is called sfumato. And sfumato is very much, it's about smoky finishes. It's almost the kind of defining characteristic of Leonardo's work. If you see that kind of technique of sfumato being used, you're pretty sure that you're dealing with a Da Vinci, and that's how a lot of the work that's been done. Authenticating Da Vinci's, that's one of the things they look for. And one of the great things about sfumato is that it keeps things open. Again, this idea of not freezing out your understandings. Sfumato is about how we layer paintings. There are no hard edges. Shadows are more significant almost than light in all of it. And this refusing to freeze your thinking, refusing to allow yourself to believe you've come to the conclusion, you've come to the end of something, and that you're secure with that. One of his final statements that he made in his life, he used to write whenever he got a new pen, "Dimmy, tell me." And one of the last things he said was, "Dimmy, tell me if there's anything that has come of my work." So he was convinced, in fact, that the kind of search had been cut short. And he was understandably upset by this idea that maybe he hadn't finished. It was non-completion. But on the other hand, there was an acceptance of non-completion in terms of his work. A great deal of his work is incomplete. So those are the kind of seven core ideas. And I kind of want to just talk about each one now in a little bit more detail. Anyone recognize the image? The most expensive painting in the world. In my lifetime, I'm not saying when that starts, but in my lifetime, originally this painting was bought for $45. So not a bad investment. It sold in 2017 for $450 million. So the most expensive by a long, long way painting in the world. And one of the things I found fascinating about it, again, 100% sure you can see it. Can you see there's an orb here, kind of like a... And one of the reasons that it sold for $45 was that no one assumed that Da Vinci had painted this. For one simple reason, that the orb, the image within the orb, Da Vinci would have known, should be inverted. Solid glass, there should be an inversion of the image inside there. And therefore, they believed this could not be a Da Vinci. So these ideas of art and science coming together in his work, the very authenticity of a painting is undermined by the fact that a mistake has been made in terms of the science of it. I find fascinating as an idea. All of this kind of smarto and the curls and the hand, all of that highly characteristic of Da Vinci. This one element was one of the reasons why people were saying it's not a Da Vinci. So this attention to detail that he put into everything, so significant, so powerful, that actually the authentication of an entire picture depended just on that one idea.
I know that having been authenticated as Da Vinci and sold for a huge sum,
yeah,
it's now come under question again.
It has come under question again.
Do you have any, having studied Da Vinci, do you have any explanation for why a man who would have known that's not how a hand looks to an orb would have painted it that way?
The belief is that actually it was probably finished off by someone else. This was one of the unfinished pieces. And then someone just kind of, within his studio, would have done it.
Which was quite common practice at his time.
Which was extremely common practice, yeah. This here around adjacent possibilities. Again, this obsession with water, this smarto, the unknown, the unseen, the kind of blending of ideas together. What's really interesting for me, we have now become so divided in terms of the way we see education. You specialise far too early into either a science or an art, and then even within a science, within physics or maths, and then even within physics, a kind of series of, and this is the way you go. He would never have understood that, and he would have said that the kind of issues around that kind of degree of specialisation would have meant that people couldn't then see beyond their subject area. And we are therefore cutting off huge amounts of our understanding of the way the world actually works. And for him, that would have been a kind of very significant issue. These, again, very famous pictures, the Vitruvian Man here, and Study of Fetus here. What I find fascinating in both of these are just pages from his notebooks. These were never, ever set up to be looked at. He wasn't putting these out as diagrams. This was him essentially trying to prove a theory around squaring the circle and around proportion. So it's, if you like, this is a mathematical thinking through that just happened to be in one of his notebooks. If that's the case, and it seems to be the case, why this level of detail, this kind of astonishing face? Why, you know, he could have done a matchstick man to achieve the same principle in terms of his thinking, But he has, he's done this incredible, beautiful detail throughout that kind of, and it was pointless, as far as he was concerned. But it was like he couldn't help himself. So this idea of unnecessary beauty, I think, is quite significant. This, again, is surrounded by all kinds of other ideas. One of the pages in the notebook had, it's one of the last things he ever wrote, was simply the word etc. And then next to etc., he was in the middle of a mathematical equation, trying to work out, trying to balance proportions. And then he kind of wrote down, the soup is getting cold, and then wrote etc. One of the last things he ever wrote, possibly the last thing he ever wrote, the soup is getting cold. And this idea that the notebooks were simply his jottings, his mind map, his thinking through of a process. But it's hugely significant, this idea of etc. as the final thing that someone like Da Vinci would say. Tragic, almost, but very informative of the man. And apparently what had happened was that his housekeeper had called up to him that his soup was getting cold. So he just jotted it down. It looks like part of the final formula. And something quite poignant about that as an end point for the man. He was still working on some of his artwork. He had, had Mona Lisa that had been commissioned 17 years before. He still had it in his studio. So the person who commissioned it had either kind of died or kind of lost his fortune or whatever it may be. Leonardo had not finished with it. He didn't believe it was there. He didn't believe it was in the right place yet. The famous smile of Mona Lisa, he was still dissecting human beings. He dissected 30 corpses to try and find smile muscles and how the smile muscles worked. When he couldn't dissect human corpses, because it was the church looked very badly on it, he started to dissect horses to see if they had similar smile muscles. So that enigmatic Mona Lisa smile comes from the most incredibly detailed scientific observations and investigations and interrogations. That's why it is so significant. This here, again, unfinished perfection. What he did here was he captured the moment that he wanted to capture beautifully. It's a revolutionary painting at the time. But if you look here, this is kind of jotted in, unfinished up here, completely unfinished over here. Didn't bother with these figures down here either. But for him, that was it. That was the kind of, he was very content that this was a kind of bottom line issue. Here you have Saint Jerome, it's a zoomed in detail of Saint Jerome. He was still working on these neck muscles when he died, changing it, the kind of details of those neck muscles. He knew he got it wrong. And so through his dissections, he realized that there were two neck muscles controlling them, you see. So he was kind of adding and changing. So the idea of never freezing your understanding of something. Never saying, that's it, I've done it. But always looking to evolve and further evolve, I think was kind of the legacy of the man. An astonishing legacy as well. I hope it's been useful.
Thank you very much.